Hello and welcome to Inside Property. I'm Richard Blanco. The house in multiple occupation has come into focus since increased taxes and restrictions on buy-to-let loans have encouraged investors to focus on higher rental yields to maintain or improve their profitability. There's a paradox because whilst extended planning rights allow investors to add rooms, some local authorities are restricting the proliferation of HMOs to protect what they call family housing and at the behest of some local residents. Not all lenders lend to HMOs, the regulations can be a minefield, and often the management is more intensive. So what attracts property professionals to this sector and how is it for the tenants? Well, with me in the studio to discuss this are Alison Broderick, who is planning and property manager for Platinum Property Partners, Billy Gill, who's director of Open House Estate Agents and National Landlords Association representative for Hertfordshire and Northamptonshire, Richard Tacarney, who is the founder of London Property Licensing and a chartered environmental health practitioner. And joining us on the line from Swindon is Ash Zuberi, who is director of Easy Living Property Limited and also founder of HMO Group. Now, let me ask you first of all, Ash, both the tax changes and the regulation of buy-to-let mortgages, as I said, are prompting landlords to chase higher yields. Do you think HMOs are the answer?
Hi, everyone. From my perspective, on average, Easy Living Property HMOs generate a 12% gross yield, which is a lot higher than many other property investment strategies out there. So when people see those figures, yes, they, you know, it's quite clearly they do perform better and they do give a good return on investment. But if you don't know what your tax obligations are or what the lender's requirements are, those yields will mean very little.
And you manage, I think it's six HMOs that are your own, and you also manage more for other people as well, don't you, Ash? Do you see landlords going into this sector naively? What sort of issues do they need educating about?
Yeah, I mean, I see it all the time. You know, lots of people, they only just see the big cash flow numbers and the figures. They see glossy marketing material and all the lovely training courses out there, which are all good. But if you don't understand or you can't see what the legislation is or the regulations or the laws, and above all, in my opinion, you don't have the mindset to deal with your HMOs, then you're going to fail. You've got to have a good temperament and a personality. And, you know, you could educate yourself till you're blue. And if you don't have all of that, it's not going to work.
Interesting. Yes, yeah, so it's not for everybody. Let's have a look at some of the technical stuff here. And I want to bring Alison in. Alison, can you explain the difference between these planning use classes, which are C3, C4, and I think there's the other, is it sui generis, that apply to HMOs?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Richard. So the C3 use class is the use class used for family housing or flats, basically anything with a single household living in it. There's then the C4 use class, which is for HMOs of 3 to 6 individuals. And there's a permitted development right, which means you can move between those two use classes back and forth, unless it's been removed by something like an Article 4 direction. Then you have the sui generis use class, and this literally means in a class of its own. It covers all sorts of different developments, but in this context specifically, HMOs of 7 or more people fall into that. And you always need planning permission to move into or out of the sui generis class.
Now, planning, of course, can be an important part of business development, and you help HMO landlords develop their properties, don't you? What sort of developments do you help with?
Absolutely. So at Platinum, we are focused on HMOs, but we kind of do all sorts of residential development as well. So my role is really getting HMO landlords up and running, and that means getting planning permission for change of use to HMOs, site appraisals for things, making sure that you've got the permitted development rights in the first place to do things such as extensions or loft conversions, working with architects if necessary to improve layout, and also help with HMO licensing applications and liaising with building regulations as well.
And are there particular kinds of properties or locations that are suitable to turn properties into HMOs?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really about knowing your patch. I would say, obviously, with an HMO, you've got a lot more rooms to let. So being close to employment centres such as hospitals is a really good good location. Also being close to good public transport links. So, for example, close to stations or on bus routes. And then if you do need to get planning permission, it's really important to be aware of, say, how much parking's available. So usually outside of London, I'd say about 2 parking spaces minimum if you're going to make a shared house, just because in practical terms, your tenants, 2 out of 6 or 2 out of 8 are probably going to have cars.
And we are seeing an increase, aren't we, in the creation or development of HMOs. Are you finding that, Alison?
Absolutely, yeah. So the last 18 months, we've seen not only more applications for HMOs being prepared and submitted, but I've also been doing bigger HMOs. So where before I was probably doing more just change of use to say 7, we're now looking at changes to 8, 9, and also some conversions of care homes to much bigger HMOs as well.
Okay, very interesting. And now, Billy, I want to come on to you because I know that you're one of those few remaining landlords that do actually let to tenants on benefits, aren't you? NLA research tells us that less than 20% of landlords do that now. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, why you've stayed in that business and perhaps some of the pros and cons of letting to tenants on benefits in HMOs?
Thank you, Richard. Good evening. When I started HMOs, I wasn't part of Open House then and I didn't know my business partner. And so I met a guy through a charity who had a lot of demand for young people, not young people, but single men, mainly. And they were sort of ex-drug users, ex-offenders or whatever. And I found that that they had a need. And at the time, as housing benefit rates were dropping quite considerably, it generated a little bit more income. There was a big struggle, I have to admit. One of my properties was totally ruined. But eventually, the 3 properties I had, I managed to find a good balance of people who have been in with me now for sort of, you know, those. Some of them have been there for 6, 7 years now. Once they're there, they're okay. They look after the properties, they're treating it as their own. I wouldn't do any more now, not on benefits. The rents are just way too low at the moment, and they're not going to go up. So with the tax changes and everything like that, it's going to be very, very difficult.
And some of the things that put landlords off letting to tenants on benefits, sadly, are not just the fact that the local housing allowance doesn't cover the rent, but sometimes there are higher levels of management and there can be particular issues. What sort of problems have you come up against, Billy?
Again, with these people, people who are in rehab and they start drinking again or they start doing drugs again, so they'll invite their mates round, those sort of issues. Ex-offenders will try to steal from other tenants and kick down their doors. So there are those issues which are, you know, quite testing.
Okay, and of course, some tenants on benefits are fantastic and stay a long time. And, you know, I hear lots of stories from landlords where they work out very well, as some of yours obviously have.
Yeah.
Let me come on to you, Richard, because, you know, I wanted to ask you typically what kind of changes would have to be made to property to comply with HMO management requirements, because this can put some landlords off, can't it?
Yes, I think there's a lot of confusion when it comes into looking at the regulation of housing multiple occupation, and then in particular to licensing requirements. I think some of the basics are similar to a single family rented property, making sure that the gas has been checked within the last 12 months, that you've got an electrical inspection report within the last 5 years. You're then coming on to other issues such as making sure there's adequate fire precautions according to the layout, the size of the property, and making sure that the tenants have got enough space in their bedrooms, making sure they've got access to controllable heating, and that the properties can be well maintained. So I think there's some of the sort of the basic issues that need to be dealt with within all houses in multiple occupation.
Because I've always assumed that, you know, if I wanted to turn a property into an HMO, I'd have to remove all of my nice dipped original pine doors and replace them with fire doors and put fire extinguishers on the walls and make the property look really institutionalised. Am I wrong in thinking that?
There's a huge amount of confusion when it comes to fire safety in housing multiple occupation. With the regulations that came in under the Housing Act 2004, we're now looking at a risk-based approach to fire precautions. So it very much depends on the individual property. And councils and fire authorities and landlords will usually look to what's called the LACORS National Fire Safety Guidance to give them an indication what's required. So what's required for, say, 3 or 4 people sharing a flat or a house on a single tenancy could be quite different to what you'd be expecting in a larger 3-storey property converted to bedsits.
And HMO definitions, I'm thinking, say, additional licensing and mandatory licensing, leave many landlords bewildered. Is there a case for improving the law, do you think? particularly in relation to the definition of a household. It seems, you know, I hear some local authority officers complaining that people, tenants, are stuffing houses with all sorts of cousins who may not be cousins, etc., so that they can comply with the law, you know, and so that the house isn't an HMO and so on. It seems to me the law is a bit of an ass in this area. What do you think, Richard?
It's a difficult one. We had before that the Housing Act 1985, and people didn't like the HMO definition there, so they changed it in 2004. And I think it is a complex area of housing regulation. We'll probably never get to a real simple definition. I think we're stuck with what we've got. What I would suggest to landlords is they look at it in two phases, the first of which is whether their property is a house in multiple occupation. A number of criteria to look at, as you say, in issues such as whether the people living in the property are related. The second issue is whether that house in multiple occupation is one that needs to be licensed. And that answer will depend very much on the local authority where that property is located.
Now, Alison, permitted development rights can enable landlords to add rooms to a property, can't they? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So permitted development rights are essentially granting of planning permission without actually having to go through the planning process itself. It's the Town and Country Planning Act allows you to do this without asking any more. And basically, there's all sorts of different things, and it's important to remember that just because you've used one type of permitted development right doesn't mean stop you from using another. So, for example, you can do extensions to the side, extensions to the rear, garage conversions, loft conversions. They can all be done under permitted development all at the same time. So there's a few things to remember, though. You have to make sure you actually have the permitted development right. So just because they're nationally available, they can be removed per property, either by an Article 4 direction or by previous planning conditions. And the other thing is they've now brought in a new extended permitted development rights for rear extensions. So if you're a terraced property or a semi-detached property, or you can go up to 6 metres to the rear, or fully detached, you can go up to 8 metres to the rear, but you have to go through the prior approval process. So it's still permitted development, it's just you have to tell the council what you're doing. So that's just something else to think about in addition to the smaller PD rights.
So really quite a lot of opportunities there for landlords, aren't there? And, but some local authorities, as you've mentioned, do have Article 4 directions,
yes.
Which I think means that planning permission is required for all HMOs. Do most authorities resist granting planning permission in those circumstances?
Well, they're not supposed to. But that doesn't mean in practice that that isn't what happens. So essentially, they should only be bringing in an Article 4 direction if they've got a problem with HMOs such as oversaturation. Now, what's happened in practice is that most local authorities will grant it over their entire local authority area, even though it might only be one or two wards where there's an actual problem. Now, in theory, and what we found in practice generally is if you're applying for planning permission outside of those areas of high concentration, so for example, outside of the very studenty areas, they tend to be all right with granting you permission because that's not the reason they brought it in the first place. But if you are applying under the Article 4 in an overcrowded area, it's going to be very difficult to get permission, unfortunately.
And if an HMO has 7 rooms or more, it will automatically require planning permission,
yes.
Won't it?
Yes, correct.
Yes.
And that's a full planning application. It's £385. You don't have to submit a statement with it, but I think it's good practice to do so because it just highlights to the council, it's your opportunity to go through the planning policy and say, look at all the points you need me to comply with. Here's me demonstrating that I can. And it's things that, you know, It's property specific and it's local authority specific. So I would check any purchase you're looking at doing to convert to an HMO. It's not the most exciting read, but dig out the local plan, see what exactly it is requiring, because it does vary authority to authority. For example, there's some near Liverpool where they won't let you convert any property that's got a party wall with another house. Other ones have a minimum size requirement. Others have minimum parking requirements. So look at exactly what your local authority needs. And then if you comply, get the planning application together for submission.
Okay, now Ash, I know you specialise in providing sort of quite high quality HMOs, don't you? And this has been a development perhaps over the last 10 years or so. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, when I started out in sort of 2000, 2007, 2008, you know, we looked around and tried to look for information of what kind of HMO would be the best one to create. And what I saw on the market, I researched for a year, and in that year I was taken around. You know, I won't forget my first ever viewing. It was with a local estate agent here. He took me to the property, very, you know, calmly saying, yeah, you know, I've got this HMO, come and have a look. And I had to climb, in, you know, up a ladder into the loft room where this Polish lady was living. And she had, you know, put felt to cover the beams. And she was, you know, bless her, she was trying to make this loft room as habitable as possible. And you can imagine my shock. I mean, I had to climb a ladder. And then two, to see this lady standing in the middle of this loft, which hadn't been converted at all, no ventilation, no windows, just her trying to make it look like a room. And there she was standing with cash in her hand. And that, for me, was, you know, and I can give you more and more horror stories, and I'm sure that the panel have heard or seen much, much more of the same back then, especially.
Yes, sort of images of a kind of Rigsby-esque type properties, if any people remember Rising Damp.
Yeah, exactly. Even worse, you know, I've seen worse than that. You know, I can go on and on.
But you're patently not offering those sorts of properties, are you, Ash? Do yours all have ensuite bathrooms? You know, I've seen this word boutique style used around HMOs. Would you use that around some of your properties?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a marketing term, but I think that the standard is normal. You know, we're trying to bring a normal living standard for everybody out there. And if ours have en suites and maybe, you know, a TV or some nice frames, then that's just us going a bit extra. But as long as everyone that's involved in the HMO market follows, you know, a sort of set standard for living conditions that's humane across the board. So whether you're catering for students or DSS or you're doing for the higher professional market, I think, you know, that's where we all need to be. And I can say that's happening. You know, the next generation of HMO landlord is already here, and they're already pushing those old HMOs out of the market. And that was my driving factor, you know, your original question. That's what started the process for me. Once I saw that and I was exposed to that, I wanted to change that, and so do many others.
And regulation has helped that, do you think, or has it just bureaucratized things?
Improved in one sense, you know, bigger fines and jail time for those landlords and agents that are breaking the law is always good. But the councils and indeed the housing minister himself needs to listen to the PRS, with the private rented sector, more to understand what improvements can be made. And I think Richard said, you know, everything's all over the place at the moment, and we need to get to a place and where we're all on the sort of same level field. And one of those things is scrapping Section 24, you know, and maybe making a single HMO council tax. You know, there's so much room for improvement, but they, you know, we need to be sitting down together and working on those solutions instead of, you know, what's going on right now.
I'm Richard Blanco, and you're listening to Inside Property. In this programme, we're unpacking the house in multiple occupation. And with me in the studio are Alison Broderick, Planning and Property Manager from Plaston Property Partners, Billy Gill, Director of Open House Estate Agent and National Landlords Association Representative for Hertfordshire and Northamptonshire, Richard Tacani, Founder of London Property Licensing and a Chartered Environmental Health Practitioner. And joining us on the line from Swindon is Ash Zuber, who is director at Easy Living Property and founder of the HMO Group. Now, Richard, I wanted to come on to you about this issue of poor standards in HMOs. Poor standards in the private rented sector are often focused on HMOs. That's what people often talk about. Do you think they get an unfair press?
Well, some of the very worst cases are always those that are going to hit the headlines. I mean, we do see some, as Ash has referred to, there's some cases where you see some really bad exploitation of vulnerable tenants by what can only be called criminal landlords. But that doesn't represent the sector. They are a very small minority. And I've, in recent months, seen some fantastic high-quality HMO conversions travelling around London. And so I suppose those cases are out there. The sector's very diverse. There are some very poor qualities, and councils need to crack down on those. But we also need to be careful we don't just over-regulate small, low-risk HMOs.
Billy, you'll have lots of experience of managing HMOs, of course. Can you tell us about some of the challenges of getting the right mix of people in there?
It doesn't start as a challenge because, again, like Ash, we manage about 50 HMOs. Myself and my business partner are both HMO landlords ourselves, so we've got a lot of experience. We get the people in there, and that's a starting point. And then, you know, there are issues. A good classic one was a couple of years ago, one of the houses, middle of winter, one of the ladies, she wanted to open all the windows. Everybody else was cold, and they come and close the windows, and she kept on opening the windows. So you have those issues there that we have to resolve.
But presumably get some really serious stuff where tenants just are not getting on. And, you know, I've heard friends tell me about situations where they've had to, you know, mediate and in the end suggest someone ends their tenancy. And when they wouldn't, they've had to serve a Section 21 notice, et cetera, et cetera. You must have had some tricky problems like that as well, haven't you?
Yes, it has. Not a huge amount, but we do. We try and resolve it first, you know, talking to a tenant, you know, followed up by emails to make sure that they're, you know, doing as they're told. And in worst case scenario, we will issue them a notice. Some people are not designed to live with other people. They just need the lady in question. We just sort of friendly way said to her, look, you really need to have your own self-contained apartment. She understood.
And what would you say to people who argue that HMOs are just about maximising profit? I've heard councillors in East London say this to me, and that many HMOs, landlords, have little regard for property conditions or the tenants. It's just about the money for them.
Well, the first point is that we're a business, and any business should be maximising profits. That's what we're here to do. You know, you can't go to people like Marks and Spencers and not maximise your profits. That's rule number one. And secondly, you've got to have good properties to maximise your profits. You know, people are going to pay for quality. You know, if you own a restaurant and your food is rubbish, people are not going to come back. It's the same with HMOs. You have good properties. We have a good reputation as an agency. We work with good investors. People are going to come to our properties, and investors will come to us as well.
So actually maximising profit is just about running a business properly. It doesn't mean that you have to exploit people. I guess that's what you're saying, Billy.
No, you don't exploit people. What we try and do is work with our investors and ourselves as landlords and look at what we need to do, you know, how to make the profits. We're hindered by Section 24. That's going to be a big impact. Somebody said that to combat the impact, you're going to raise your rents up by 25 to 30%. And, you know, that's something we have to do. You know, I as a landlord would never do that if that wasn't going to affect me. Unfortunately, it is. So we're having to sort of put those rents up now, to be honest.
We'll see what happens, won't we? Because, of course, rental demand is falling in many areas. But, Richard, let's come back to you. And I wanted to ask you about Article 4 directions, because we now have 8, I believe, in London. Do you think we're going to see any more? These are Article 4 directions that prevent HMOs.
I think we'll continue to see some more, particularly in the London market, which is the one I know the best. I think it's probably just over a quarter of London boroughs now have brought in some planning restrictions on changing from C3 to C4 HMOs. I think some of those are borough-wide, others just covering a small ward and a localised area. Most are brought in with a year's notice, and it's worth making that point, that you very occasionally see them implemented immediately, but they're normally given prior notice. But there does seem to be that level of concern about losing family accommodation. And ultimately, we need a mix of all types of accommodation within the housing market.
Yes, exactly. And one of the concerns is that if we have fewer HMOs, then we won't have enough accommodation for sharers. Do you think HMOs are making a positive or negative contribution to the housing crisis in London?
They're an essential part of the housing market. We've got a huge shortage of accommodation in London. Rents are at record levels. There are many people, particularly young professionals, who would look to try and rent a good quality room in a shared house to help them move into London and maybe longer term look for shared ownership or other purchase options, perhaps, or even to move back to other parts of the country. It suits them. Work maybe short term, and they're looking for good quality accommodation. So HMOs are a fundamental and important part of the housing market.
Now, cynics might argue that local authorities are bringing in this additional HMO licensing as a way to fund their cash-strapped private rented sector housing teams. What do you think about that?
Well, the Housing Act's quite clear that additional and, of course, selective licensing schemes can only be brought in quite specific circumstances where councils can prove that there's a need to bring in those schemes. So ultimately, the money that's collecting in fees, and we are seeing licensing fees increase, I think, there's certainly a trend of that in recent times, but that money can only be invested back into the running of the licensing scheme. It can't be used for adult social care or for repairing the roads or collecting the rubbish. You know, it's only going to be used for the licensing scheme.
Now, Alison, some of the arguments that get made against HMOs when planning applications are put in, I suspect, are things like that they might blight the local community by bringing in transient residents and cause fly tipping and antisocial behaviour. What sorts of complaints do you come up against when you're trying to put forward planning applications?
Yeah, I mean, they are rarely welcomed by neighbours, I would say, planning applications that we submit. The main concerns outside of London tend to be parking. There's a concern that six people are going to have six cars, that are going to have six boyfriends or girlfriends, that are going to have six cars, and you know, the street's going to turn into a car park. That's the big one. And then refuse and, you know, not... I think the perception of HMOs isn't perhaps the most positive. People tend to think of students and a lack of sort of engagement with their community. So there's a bit of a fear that they won't put the bins out properly, there might be rats or that sort of thing. But you know, we try and encourage all the franchise partners in PPP to go and meet your neighbours before you submit a planning application. Take your business card round, take a brochure, you know, pictures of your other properties you've already got, and sort of try and allay their fears and show that, you know, it's a different type of HMO, explain what an HMO is and what type of tenants are going to be like and that sort of thing, and try and head it off at the pass. You're always going to have the way planning works, neighbours are always consulted and they have an opportunity to make their voice heard. If you can engage with them before that process starts and maybe come to a compromise on something, you might find that that gets your planning application through a bit easier.
That all sounds very sensible to me, and I'm a great advocate of talking to your neighbours and befriending them. They will often keep an eye on the property for you as well and tell you what's going on there. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yes, can be very valuable. Ash, some people argue that we're reaching saturation points with HMOs in some areas and that, you know, the rental demand just can't sustain anymore. What's your view on that, and how is demand in the areas where you're working?
Interesting. You know, there's... You know, demand and saturation will go up and down in any area, including mine. Some areas even more, depending on what's going on there. It could be a city, it could be a university town. The market is constantly changing. It has done historically. It always has. It always will. What the key question here is those that are doing the arguing and putting out this that saturation is having, have they stress-tested their HMO properly? Did they do that before that? Did they factor all the negative market effects that could happen on their HMO? It's those people that, you know, may not have factored all those consequences that are struggling, and the ones who have put all those things in, they're the ones that can ride out any kind of negative or saturated market, in my opinion.
Now, it can be quite tricky to get finance as well, can't it, Ash? I was looking today at the Mortgage Works, which is, you know, typical buy-to-let lender, and their best rate at 65% loan-to-value for a standard buy-to-let was 1.69%, but for an HMO, it was 3.14%, and indeed 65% is as much as they lend. So what are the challenges of trying to get finance for HMOs?
There are some challenges. You know, lenders are always changing their product lines. We've seen it in recent months with everyone coming out with new products and trying to be more competitive. So it can be challenging if you are a newbie and if you don't have the track record behind you. But if you've got a good, you know, you're a seasoned landlord in some cases, or, you know, you have a portfolio behind you, then you are going to get the better rates. And what I've seen are those people or individuals in those situations are the ones that are getting the best products.
Now, does the high level of management involved in HMOs really make it worth it, Ash? Because I must admit, I'm a bit put off by the idea. What do you think?
It's pivotal. It's absolutely, you know, it's up there in the top three. If you can't manage, you know, your HMO to a very high level, then it's going to fail. The other thing is you find a competent agent to do it for you, and those are few.
Perhaps I should turn to Billy on this, actually, because I'm hoping he is a competent agent. I'm sure he is. Billy, do you ever have HMO landlords sort of coming to you in despair, saying, take it off me and manage it for me?
We have, yes, basically. Who try to self-manage. As I said, we manage about 50 HMOs ourselves as Open House now, so we've got a good concept going. It is harder work. One of our biggest points is our cleaners, actually. They're our eyes and ears. They go in every week, so they will tell us exactly if something's going wrong. And what we have is a nice little situation. We just put a whiteboard up, so the tenants will write and the cleaners will come back to us. Sometimes tenants always, you know, might not phone you if there's sort of little issues there. So that's very key. Constant property inspections as well. We have, you know, 6 full-time staff now, so that, you know, one or two of them are always out every day inspecting the properties, going into the rooms, making sure everything is okay. But we've had ex-student landlords. We had a bit of an overflow for student properties a little while ago because the college built, or the university built, a big complex of 500 rooms, so a number of student landlords came over to us, and we helped to convert them into sort of professional lets.
Okay, and in fact, looking at NLA research, the average yield for property is 5.8%, but it's 7.4% for HMOs, 6.6% for student lets, and 6% for tenants on benefits. So the yields are higher, but of course, there's quite a lot more management. Now, for those property professionals who are thinking, thank goodness my property isn't an HMO, actually, the government is thinking of changing the definition of an HMO, and quite a lot more properties might be brought into scope. Currently, there have to be 3 stories or more with 5 people or more living in 2 households or more. The story element of that is being removed, isn't it, Richard? So what impact do you think this change in HMO definition will have in London?
Well, it's worth making clear it's not a change to the HMO definition per se, but it's a change to those HMOs that will need licensing under the rules and regulations. So the changes, you're right, the changes will come in across England. Government have said that they're committed to bring this in, and after the general election, we may well see these changes start, perhaps around about October of this year. And it will mean that, in effect, all properties share 5 or more people across the whole of England will need to be licensed, regardless of whether they're in a flat, a 2-storey house, or a larger 3-storey or higher property. So across England, the government suspect kind of 170,000 plus properties will be brought within licensing for the first time.
Wow, OK, so that's a substantial increase, isn't it? So food for thought there for lots of us who have properties that aren't 3 stories but maybe rent to 5 or more people who are sharers. Well, we've come to the end of the programme, and I'd like to thank my guests, Ash Zuberi, Alison Broderick, Billy Gill and Richard Carney. Remember, you can get in touch with the programme through our website, insideproperty.org.uk. And all that remains is for me to thank you for listening, and please join us again next time. Inside Property is produced in collaboration with the National Landlords Association.